Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For 5 years since Michelle Obama's school lunch law was passed, food fights about its tougher nutrition standards have sprung up around the country. Here in New Hampshire, one such dispute ended last week between Londonderry High School and the USDA with an agreement that the school will be able to operate outside the National Lunch Program and the feds will hold back on other regulations. And nationwide, while some school food service directors are saying that kids just haven't been eating the healthier meals and that their budgets are suffering, others praise the law as long overdue and an important step in fighting childhood obesity. Today in The Exchange, quarreling over school lunch. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We begin the hour with Allison Aubrey. She's NPR's food correspondent. Allison, thank you for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Hi, good to be here this morning, Laura.
Well, just give us the background, if you could, please, Allison, the how, when, and why of these school lunch standards, especially Michelle Obama's role.
Sure. Well, about 5-6 years ago, Congress passed the Healthy, Hungry, Hunger-Free Kids Act, as it was known, and that basically stipulated that the rules about what can be served in school lunch and in breakfasts needed to be rewritten. And at the end of the day, what was passed was regulations that said kids need to have a fruit or vegetable at every meal that needs to be put on the lunch tray every day. There needs to be a lot more whole grains and a lot less salt. And for the most part, that's what has been accomplished. There was just a study published in JAMA Pediatrics earlier this month, showing that the nutritional quality of school meals has increased by about 30%. So, you know, kids are getting more nutrient-dense foods, so more vitamins, more fiber, and slightly fewer calories.
So the quality of the meals has gone up. The question everybody's asking, and I'd love your thoughts, Allison, is, are they eating it? I mean, you can serve it, but do they eat it?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a little bit of conflicting evidence about whether there's a little bit more plate waste or tray waste, as it's called. I mean, I've seen studies pointing in both directions, but I think at the end of the day, when you're putting fruits and vegetables on the tray every day, you're sending a signal of, you know what, hey, this is what a good meal looks like. And there's lots of efforts in place to try to figure out what to do when kids aren't open to the idea of, say, having an orange or a tangerine on their tray. A lot of schools are experimenting with what are called share tables. So say you don't like the fruit or vegetable that was put on your tray, you can take it over to the share table, leave it there, maybe swap it for something you do like. Also, the CDC and the USDA are working on new guidance to try to help schools put more salad bars in. Because when you put a salad bar in, you get this sort of Chipotle effect where kids get to pick what they want. And that's appealing because it puts more control in their hands.
Absolutely. So when did some of the pushback against these standards begin, Allison? From what I understand, it wasn't right at the beginning. It was a couple years in.
That's right. I mean, it hasn't been smooth sailing for these schools because a lot of them were being asked to make wholesale changes. And there were a lot of costs involved, particularly for schools that weren't in the habit of serving, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables every day. So in the beginning, about a year in, schools started to say, hey, these rules are hard to live by. A lot of the staples that we used to serve, white tortillas, biscuits, we can't serve those anymore. We have to put fruits and vegetables on every tray. That's driving up our costs. Sometimes we're, you know, having salad bars, that's more labor intensive, and we see fewer kids in the lunch line. There were fewer paying kids, fewer kids in the lunch line who were paying for their meal in the 2 years after the standards went into effect. Now, not by huge margins. We're talking 2 to 3% dips. But when you look at the way a school lunch program can operate, a 2 to 3% dip in participation plus the added cost of ingredients that maybe you didn't used to buy, you can see where some the managing the school lunch budget became a little bit tougher. And so the School Nutrition Association went to Congress and said, hey, a lot of our members are having trouble. Can you relax some of these rules as we figure it out? And it sort of got ugly from there because there was sort of the practical part of schools trying to implement these wholesale changes. And then there was the political part where you had some members of Congress who were sort of philosophically opposed to how much of a strict mandate was coming from Washington. And when you unravel the sort of politics from the practical part, there are now solutions in place for the practical part. Congress is basically saying, okay, we can give you more time to meet the low sodium standards. We can be a little bit more flexible on whole grains. And so all in all, it's sort of looking like we're ending up with a compromise. It's not a completely done deal yet, but the Senate Agriculture Committee just passed a huge compromise bill, and everybody seems to be happy. The School Nutrition Association and public health advocates who had been crying foul, saying, "Hey, please don't roll back these standards that we tried so hard to put in place."
What about the USDA, Allison? In the past, anyway, the school lunch program was described by some as kind of a dumping ground for USDA surplus.
Yeah, well, to an extent, that's still in place. But I must say, if you're a school and you're being asked to follow these standards that are put in place by the Healthy and Hunger-Free Kids Act, it's not a dumping ground for bad stuff anymore. I mean, look, the meals that most schools are serving up are, as I said, include a whole lot more fruits and vegetables, a lot more whole grains, a lot less salt. And, you know, so you might get some cheese from the USDA at a low price. You're going to incorporate that into your overall, nutritional picture. So I think it's not sort of fair to say that it's sort of a dumping ground for bad stuff that we don't need.
What's next on this, Allison? You mentioned a committee bill and some echoes of compromise.
Yeah, I think it has to. This compromise has to wend its way through Congress, and also, there's work to do in coming up with. As I mentioned, the CDC and the USDA are going to get their heads together to figure out how to promote the concept of salad bars while at the same time assuaging fears that there's a food safety risk. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work to be done to sort of encourage salad bars and work with school food administrators. And I think that for the most part, we'll see where this bill goes, and we'll also see what happens with the funding that the president just asked for to expand nutritious meals to be served throughout the summer, which is also part of this whole child nutrition authorization program.
Well, Allison, thank you again for taking time with us.
All right. Take care. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Allison Aubrey again. She's NPR's food correspondent. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at school lunches, where they are 5 years after stricter nutrition regulations went into place. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Stacy Perslow joins us from UNH. She's with New Hampshire's Farm to School program. She's the coordinator there. Stacy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also with us in studio, Amanda Vincenzia. She's Dining Services Director at Londonderry School District, which pulled the high school out of the National School Lunch Program last year. And Amanda, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And also Doris Demers, Vice President of New Hampshire School Nutrition Association and Nutrition Director at Oyster River Cooperative School District. And Doris, welcome. Good to have you, too.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Doris, I think I'll turn to you first. So Allison Aubrey explained sort of broadly what these rules are all about. Getting down to the specific level, what are your lunches supposed to be like today versus the lunches that you were preparing 5 years ago before these rules went into effect?
Actually, 5 years ago, our lunches weren't a lot different, very different from what we're doing now, basically because I have been involved in the School Nutrition Association. It has been 22 years that I've been in this business, and for the last 13 years, I've been very involved on the board of Maine School Nutrition Association and now in New Hampshire. And the good thing about involvement is that you see the rules coming and the changes coming, and you can do them before they actually hit and they're forced down your throat. So that actually helped me to prepare and start students with more fruits and vegetables and with whole grains. We did it before it was the rule. So there are some things. Tortillas have been the hardest thing because kids like flavored tortillas. Students today go out to eat a lot more than they did when we were kids. So they're used to having a wide variety available to them. And if you go to just a plain whole wheat tortilla, a lot of them will really miss the flavors. We do a chili jalapeno one and your garlic and herb and your spinach and your tomato. And they really like those choices. Salad bars and deli bars really help bring in the participation. And in a district such as mine, and actually the last three districts I've been in have all been very low free and reduced, you don't have guaranteed participation. The district I'm in now, our high school, is open campus. So those students, at least the upper grades, can get in their car and drive down the street. And
so you really have to step it up because otherwise they're just going to go somewhere else.
You do. You have to be competitive. You have to offer them what they want. But yet we have to stay within the regulations.
Well, Allison mentioned sodium, whole grains, and that mandate for fruits and vegetables, a fruit or vegetable at every meal. What's been hardest for you, Doris, to do time and time and time again? Is it the sodium? Is it the whole grain? Is it the fruit and veggie mandate?
I would say it's the fruit and veggie mandate, not at the lower elementary schools or at the middle school. The middle school has been a bit of an issue, but especially at the high school. Those students do not want to be told what to take.
So, what a surprise.
Right. So what happens is they still buy lunch, but they don't buy a reimbursable meal. So they're paying a la carte prices for, you know, their entree and their milk because they don't have that fruit or vegetable on their tray. And then the parents call and say, why are my kids going through so much money? It's because they don't want to take what we call a meal deal, which is actually a reimbursable meal. You can't force them to take it.
Yeah.
So
how about you, Amanda? As I said in my introduction, Londonderry High School pulled out of the school lunch program, although the middle school and the elementary schools are still involved. What was it that made Londonderry take that decision?
Absolutely. So what happened was last year they had had a lot of student feedback saying that they were not accepting the new changes. And what's happening is that these students, it's not a part of what I call their household food culture. If whole grains are not being served at home, it's very difficult for them to accept them in the school district because it's not familiar to them. The flavor profile is very different. And there are some things that just don't translate effectively from a white flour to a wheat flour. In terms of baking, it's very, very difficult sometimes to get our whole wheat muffins correct in terms of baking because it's such a science. I'm terrible at it. I am a great baker. But the student acceptability was down. Our participation rates were very, very were much lower than they had been in previous years. And the students were saying, we're not getting enough food. We have a lot of athletes. We have a lot of students in extracurricular activities who are at the school for an elongated school day. They were saying, we want more on a plate. And with the restrictions in terms of calorically, at specifically the high school, we were unable to give them what they wanted in the portion size that they wanted it in. So they looked at it in a multitude of different fashions, did a lot of different financial comparisons. And Salem High School actually withdrew from the National School Lunch Program on a test basis last year. And this year marked the first year that both Londonderry High School and Salem High School did not submit an application for the National School Lunch Program. We both made the decision that this year would be the first year we would rescind 100% and run our own private programs.
So two things going on. One was the kids just didn't like some of the tastes.
Correct.
And two, to meet these stricter calorie, salt, fat requirements, the portions were smaller and some kids were saying, I'm starving.
Absolutely. Some of the USDA foods that we were receiving, for example, the beef patties that didn't have some of the things that contributed to the higher fat content or higher sodium content caused those burgers to shrink. So putting a smaller burger on a 3.5-inch whole wheat bun, which is a very, very dark color grain, was very unfamiliar and unacceptable to our students.
Well, and Stacey, I want to bring you into this too, but one more question for you, Amanda. How do you pull these two desires together? I mean, obviously you want the kids to eat, you want them to not be hungry. On the other hand, you do recognize the need for kids to have less, I mean, all of us, not just kids, whole grains, less salt, less fat, and so forth. So how do you blend those two desires?
Absolutely. So what we've done is pretty much just gone a little bit backwards to the National School Lunch Program where it was in school year 2013. And in school year 2013, 50% of our whole grains, of our grains had to be whole grains. So we did that and we're integrating whole grains and introducing them and making them familiar to the students, but not forcing it down their throats. If you ever tell a high school student that they have to do something, it is going to be impossible for them because immediately their defenses go straight up and say, well, how dare you tell me I must do this? So we're trying to integrate it more into them becoming familiar with what is a mushroom? And let's talk about the four different ways in which you can eat a mushroom rather than put this on your plate or you can't eat today.
Well, Stacey, let's bring you into this. And again, you're with New Hampshire's Farm to School program. What are your thoughts on that last point that Amanda was talking about? Everybody's down with the goal of, you know, getting kids to eat healthier, but it's hard.
It is hard, and some of the projects that we do at Farm to School, particularly with our school garden work, which has shown to increase the consumption of particularly vegetables because the kids are growing the food, that they're more likely to eat the food. And if we can get some of that garden-grown food into the cafeteria, then it becomes a really big deal where the students are really proud of, wow, we grew that food, and now we're going to eat it. So it becomes a really cool thing, and they want to eat it. So, and I've also heard from other school districts that, yes, there was a curve of when they implemented these new requirements, yet participation went down, but we are hearing that now participation is increasing or that their fruit and vegetable consumption is increasing. And particularly one school district who's had to increase her budget for fruits and vegetables, even though at a certain point it went down, but now it's way up again.
You know, so, Stacey, I've heard that farm to table is, you know, big in New Hampshire. The restaurants are embracing it and so forth. But that when it comes to schools, it's tough because you could bring them all the fresh veggies in the world, but they may not have the actual kitchen capability to deal with it. I wonder what you've seen on that score.
That is true with some schools that they don't necessarily have the time to wash and chop heads of lettuce. They may be able to get their lettuce in pre-cut, and so that saves a lot of labor. But other schools are okay with that, so it just depends.
What do you think, Doris?
We actually have a large farm-to-school program at Oyster River. We're very lucky because we have the support of the district and the community. And I haven't heard of this in any other district, so I know I'm extremely lucky. In 2012, which was my first year there, the Sustainability Committee pulled together a town warrant, which passed unanimously to give the food service program $14,000 towards the purchase of local foods. And that was huge because that was $14,000 worth of food that didn't have to come out of my budget. I was so impressed to hear that. The following year, it went up to $15,000, and it has been $15,000 last year and this year as well. That really kind of takes the pressure off because I agree with Amanda about the beef patties from USDA. So we buy grass-fed local beef, and it's really well received by the students. But I know that not all districts can afford that. We do buy from a lot of different – we probably buy 10% of our total food budget comes locally. And that's not counting milk.
That sounds like a lot, actually.
It is. So $22,000 one year. I think I'm up to about 10,000 now, and we're only in January. So it has been hard, though, to source some of those things.
Reliably and so forth. We'll talk more in just a moment, and we'll take your questions, comments, observations, thoughts on the school lunch program and how it's changing. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the food fight over school lunch. As stricter nutrition regulations go into their fifth year, some New Hampshire students and schools have pushed back against these federal guidelines to make meals healthier. But as we're hearing, the rules have many supporters, too, who say that serving food with less sodium, fat, and calories is a necessity. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Doris Demers is with us in studio, Vice President of New Hampshire's School Nutrition Association and Nutrition Director at Oyster River Cooperative School District, along with Amanda Venencia. She's Dining Services Director at Londonderry School District, which pulled the high school out of the National School Lunch Program last year. Joining us by phone, Stacy Perslow. She's New Hampshire's Farm-to-School Program Coordinator. She's based at UNH. One more time, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And first up is Josh in Plymouth. Hi, Josh. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a comment, I guess, on another aspect of this. I have some involvement with a program that delivers food to needy children, you know, when they're not in school hours. And because of, you know, I know the intentions are in the right place, but it's the same thing because of money and stuff. A lot of the food is, you know, like ramen noodles and Campbell's soup, just high sodium, high fat stuff that's fairly cheap that you can buy in bulk. So I don't know. I just like to hear the comments on after school feeding and things like
okay.
that.
Okay. Yeah. And that's becoming increasingly important, Josh. Thank you for the call. Doris, go ahead.
Josh, are you talking about a backpack program?
I think, Josh, I'm not sure. Are you still with us, Josh?
I'm still.
Yeah.
Well, it's, there's some through the school, and then there's some through local churches. And
right.
Basically, when the kids aren't in school is when they're in need of food, too. So, you know, they deliver it to the homes.
Right.
And a lot of it's just stuff you buy at BJ's, you know, just bulk stuff because it's cheap.
Right. High fat, high sodium, and very little fiber, I'm imagining. Go ahead, Doris.
I do have we do have a backpack program at our district as well. And when we signed up for that, it came along with a list of suggested foods. And the idea of the foods that are in the bag are actually for children to fix themselves. So they have to be things that they could do without a parent there, because you have to assume that there isn't a parent available to cook those meals. And so it has to be easy to prepare things. What we did, though, is we took that basket of food and we upgraded it. We put in whole grain bread. We put in whole grain bagels. We stopped doing ramen noodles and we did pasta with sauce. I think that more and more children are learning to cook now, with cooking such a craze on TV. Mm-hmm. And we did upgrade it. There's much less sodium, but it's still kid friendly. So that's something that if you worked with the people that are putting it together, they could actually swap out some of those things. Those Pop-Tarts and those ramen noodles could go and be replaced with something healthier.
Amanda, did you want to jump in too?
Yes. Hi, Josh. So what you're looking at right there is you're looking at the financial responsibility and decision-making process of these individuals who are putting together these programs. And they're looking to expand their dollars as far as it's going to go to feed as many people as they want. Unfortunately, in America today, the demand for whole grain products is not there. Therefore, manufacturing is not as efficient in creating those whole grain products, and therefore the price is higher. And that's what we're seeing in school meals. For example, when we have a distributor that is bringing in products specifically for schools that they cannot sell to restaurants because there's no demand in American society, we have to pay an increased price. So for organizations that are looking to expand their dollar, they're going to go for items that are cheap, that it can feed as many students as they can so that they can reach as many students as they can, which is probably one of their main goals.
Yeah. So you, again, it's these competing goals. You
Absolutely.
Want kids to eat well, but you want them to eat. And as you say, Amanda, you have to make at least break even on these programs. You can't be losing money, or the school district will have to dip in from other funds to pay for school lunches. And they don't want to do that, Doris, right?
Right, right. One thing, though, is that, you know, just saying that kids aren't going to eat it, I feel, is really not what our job is. Our mission is to get them eating the better food. And as far back as 5 years ago, white bread was being outsold by whole wheat. So people are changing. They're not all there. Just yesterday I was in a classroom doing a menu planning activity with students, and I asked how many ate whole wheat bread at home, and two-thirds of the class did. So families are buying whole grains. And I think it's going to take a while for it to move over to the pastas and things like that. But it is coming. It's just a slow work in progress.
Well, here's an email that came in from Jeffrey, who says, success of the school lunch program should be measured by what school students eat. Determining the success of the National School Lunch Program should also include monitoring or measuring how much food is not eaten and gets thrown away. We must never lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of kids in this country who get their best meal of the day at school. I want to address the throwaway issue in a minute, but what about that second point, Stacey? We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that for some kids, that school lunch is the big meal of the day.
It is, particularly for our underserved communities. Parents are relying on school lunch and even school breakfast or even an after-school program to help feed their kids. And you know, the 68 hours of hunger came out of this because they're not getting those meals at home on the weekend. So it's really important to have healthy food at these meal programs.
Well, and joining us now on that other piece, the question of how much is being served versus thrown away, is Jessica Donzie-Black. She's with the Pew Charitable Trust, which has been looking at the research surrounding school lunch. And Jessica, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, several organizations have been studying the impact of these new rules at the level where it matters most. Students are supposed to eat it. Lots of groups have looked at the data from, you know, USDA to, you know, Harvard School of Public Health. What have you found? You looked at several of these studies.
Yes, there's been several big studies that have come out over the past year that, you know, people were doing research in advance of updated nutrition standards coming out, and so were able to measure what students were taking and consuming at baseline, and then did follow-up post-implementation of updated nutrition standards in schools where things had changed dramatically. As Doris mentioned, some schools were well ahead of the curve, so we in those cases saw, you know, a smooth transition. And what the studies find overall is that students are, in fact, choosing more fruits and vegetables, just as we would expect, since it's required to be part of the meal. And, in fact, they're consuming more fruits and vegetables, and in some cases, more parts of their entrees or whole grains. And interestingly enough, the studies are finding they're not throwing away more. When we look at sort of in aggregate across a large number of districts and a lot of different situations, they're not throwing away more. That said, food waste has always been a really challenging issue in the school environment for lots of reasons. Timing of meals, length of meals, how long kids have to eat, et cetera. So there's lots of things to look at in that space.
So they're not throwing away more because we've seen headlines about, you know, new school lunches, kids hate them, they're chucking them. But you're saying not so.
Well, there's been a perception that kids are throwing away more, and I think for those people who hadn't been in school cafeterias previously, if they walk over and look in the trash can and they see, you know, half-eaten things thrown away, that perception is, see, we're throwing away more. But when you really measure it, you know, when they went in and did plate waste measurement pre and post, they found that actually waste wasn't going up. Now, by nature of the foods being healthier, some of what's in the trash can is healthier too, and so the look might be healthier. But that said, the amount in the trash can, you know, from a research perspective, isn't increasing.
Well, I wonder if the amount wasn't increasing, Jessica, because the meals themselves are smaller.
I think, again, you know, some of the perception that meals are smaller is variable across districts. In many districts, they're offering, you know, unlimited amounts of fruits and vegetables and things. So students may have very full plates when they come through the line. There were calorie limits added, you know, with the updated nutrition standards that in some cases did dial back entree sizes. But in many cases, districts were able to offer sort of larger amounts of other things. And in fact, some districts tell us sometimes they have a challenge meeting calorie minimums because in incorporating all of the fruits and vegetables and whole grains and other things, they find actually sometimes it's hard to meet the minimum calories in certain age groups. So I think, you know, that's variable as well.
So here we are, 5 years out. You're talking about the lunches becoming healthier. Seems like maybe the kids are eating some of these better ingredients. Do we have any evidence yet, Jessica, on whether these standards are helping kids, you know, be healthier and lose weight if they need to?
We're starting to see that evidence coming through. There isn't yet great pre-post evidence, you know, looking specifically at the updated meal standards and what the impact of health had been. That said, there are a lot of places, you know, as Doris had mentioned, that got started with these changes earlier, have been implementing healthy standards, you know, over the last 10 plus years. And in some of those places, there has been analysis of health outcomes as well. And to the extent we have that data, it shows that, in fact, when we're serving healthier foods in schools, it is leading to healthier kids. One particular study looked not just at the school meal environment, but really at that whole school environment. So for, you know, always what is in the school cafeteria in a meal has for many years been the healthiest option among what's sold in schools. Sometimes the challenge is then kids have access to lots of less healthy options in vending machines or school stores or other places around the school. And in districts that had gotten ahead and updated those standards and had served healthier foods across the school environment, we actually see, you know, better health outcomes among those students.
Sure.
Even including healthier weights.
And among elementary school kids, they're kind of a captive audience. But as we've been hearing from our New Hampshire guests, you know, the high schoolers, if they don't like it, they'll just go to the vending machine. They'll go across the street to the pizza shop. If rules allow, they'll stay hungry and come home and inhale the refrigerator. I mean, with the high school kids, it's especially tricky.
Yeah, about 3 out of 4 high schools in this country are actually closed campuses. So they don't necessarily have options outside of high school. That said, some do. And so that changes the environment. But you know, that's why it's so important when we talk to different school nutrition directors and administrators and students and parents, it's so important that we're making sure we're sending consistent messages across the campus so that, you know, students have a range of healthy foods to choose from, but they're all healthy choices. So regardless of whether they're going to the vending machine or they're going to the school store or they're going to the cafeteria, you know, they're getting similarly nutritious options in all of those places.
One of the barriers that you guys at Pew looked at that schools have faced into coming into compliance with these new standards, Jessica, is the lack of appropriate kitchen equipment. Tell us a little bit more about that, Jessica. That was kind of an eye-opener for me that, you know, one of the struggles is just not having the right knives or the right cutting space.
Absolutely. So historically, if we go back in time, there were funds available for equipment and infrastructure grants. And that funding went away in the 80s. And until, you know, the kind of 2010, there hadn't really been any funding available. Through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the USDA was able to make available $100 million in equipment grants. But in the limited time that that money, that the grant window was open, they had over $600 million in requests. So that sort of sparked our attention to look into this issue and dive a little deeper. And so in 2012, we did a huge study called the Kitchen Infrastructure and Training Study that really looked at what the equipment and infrastructure needs were in districts. And we found that, you know, in the vast majority of districts, they indicated having significant equipment needs. And in fact, in 92% of New Hampshire's districts, they said they needed at least one piece of kitchen equipment in order to serve more nutritious foods. And in fact, in 55% of districts, they said they needed some infrastructure changes. So it might be electricity or space, but that major changes were needed in order to do this really effectively and efficiently.
Bigger freezers, bigger fridges, just basic stuff like that. So, Allison Aubrey from NPR joined us at the beginning of the show, Jessica, and said that there's actually compromise in the air on Capitol Hill on some of these issues. What are you seeing?
The Senate Agriculture Committee worked really hard in a bipartisan way to talk to stakeholders across the board and get a sense of, you know, how we could move forward productively, how we can support kids' health and support schools in implementing nutrition. And so they came up with a bill that, in fact, passed out of the Agriculture Committee. So it's the first step of an ongoing process with unanimous support across party lines. And so it's really encouraging in terms of looking for a path forward that will continue to, you know, kind of support serving healthy foods, but do it in a way that provides some more assistance to schools through training and equipment and infrastructure and additional support for farm to school and other programs.
All right. Well, Jessica, thank you very much for taking time out.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jessica Donzi Black. Again, she's with the Pew Charitable Trusts and director of the Kids Safe and Healthful Foods Program. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Before we go back to our listeners, all of you, Stacey Perslow, what jumps out at you from some of that information that Jessica gave us saying, yeah, maybe kids are eating this stuff?
Again, they are eating this stuff, and I'll just go back to the school garden program and even the local foods piece, and Doris can jump in on that, of just the quality and the taste of the local food, whether they grew it in their garden or they got it from a local farm, is just so much better than stuff that might be coming out of California or Florida.
What would you change, Doris, about this program if you could?
About the time, the eating times, the lunch times in a lot of schools are not long enough. And, you know, you think about a child who's got three missing teeth and now they've got a plate full of raw vegetables. They need time to chew that food. And it's not good nutrition unless it goes in. So you'll have a child who'll make a beautiful plate and then all of a sudden, you know, the aide is telling them, wrap it up, and that's when the food goes in the garbage.
But that's an interesting point. Apart from the whole standards and what about fat and what about sodium and so forth, the time the kids have to eat. You're right. I have heard that complaint that, Mom, by the time I finished getting my lunch, I had 2 minutes to eat it. I couldn't eat it, and I threw it out, and now I'm starving, and I inhale the refrigerator.
We have worked hard to with administration to get the lunch periods to where the students have a good amount of time to eat. The problem is not all students eat at the same rate. You know, not all children have all their teeth. So you might have somebody that's done and they're starting to want, you know, get rambunctious and they think, okay, it's time for these kids to go. But yet on the same table, there might be two of them that are really struggling to get that food in and they were slow eaters. So it is hard to make it right for everybody.
Here's an email that just came in from Chris in Manchester, who has a question for you, Amanda. He says, could she please comment on the financial aspects of Londonderry's decision to take their high school off the National School Lunch Program? Chris says, specifically, does the school district do anything to provide financial assistance to students who would qualify for federal meal assistance? And how much money in local tax dollars does Londonderry have to contribute to the food service program to offset the loss? So there's some detail in there, Amanda, and folks might not understand how the school lunch program works. Basically, you know, a chunk of kids in every district get their meals paid for, and then they're paying students as well, and the federal government kind of makes up some of the costs there. But go ahead if you could answer his question.
Exactly. So within the National School Lunch Program, when we talk about a reimbursable meal, we're talking about the government actually sponsoring that student to eat. And that is either at a free or reduced rate, depending on the financial stability of the household, the number of students, the number of family members that are in the household, and how much money is brought in. So in Londonderry, our rate is very low. We have 7% of the families in our district who qualify for free and reduced rates. And a stipulation of us coming from the National School Lunch Program at the high school was continuing to allow those families to access food at those rates.
Sure, because that's important for them.
Absolutely. Our school board was 100% on board with that. They were very supportive of that. And it's resulting in approximately about $40,000 that the general fund is contributing to dining services over the course of the year to feed those students both breakfast and lunch. And in terms of where we're looking at to be towards the end of the year, we're looking pretty great. The school board was also very supportive of giving us $50,000 to invest in the facility because we needed the space to give the kids what they wanted.
Yeah, and are you getting, maybe you can answer this after a break, are you getting more paying kids, you know, kids who
Absolutely.
Can pay full freight, and that subsidizes the kids who can't?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you very much for the email. More of your questions and comments after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at school lunches and some big changes in nutrition standards around these meals that went into effect about 5 years ago. 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We want your questions and comments about school lunches and breakfast, by the way. The standards cover them as well. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Amanda, just before the break, you were responding to an email from Christopher who wanted to know that since Londonderry pulled the high school out of the federal school lunch program, are kids who need subsidized school meals still getting that subsidy? You said yes, absolutely. What's happening on the paying end then, the kids who are paying full freight for those meals?
So what we're finding is that the students are buying their meal and then buying a second meal. So they're not only buying our chicken lettuce wrap, they're buying a second chicken lettuce wrap. They're not going into the snack room and buying a bag of chips. They're not going into the snack room and buying a frozen yogurt, which, by the way, is fat-free and 100 calories for a half a cup. I mean, it's an absolutely fantastic, you know, addition to our a la carte sampling, and it is an extremely great example of how we're balancing our financial responsibility with our nutritional integrity. But what we're finding from the students is they're backing it up with their money. They're saying, we want more food on a plate, and that's what we're going to buy. We're going to buy a second meal, and we're all for that.
Jump indoors.
I just wanted to say that even if you are in a national school lunch program, they can buy an additional entree if they want to. And the subsidy for free and reduced meals isn't the only part the district would lose. They would also lose the subsidy for the paid meals, because every child's meal is subsidized at some point to
even
a small
those who,
degree.
Quote unquote,
even
pay
those
full
that
freight.
Are full pay, there's a small amount of subsidy that comes, about 24 cents per meal. So that's an additional amount of revenue loss to the district. I totally respect Londonderry's choice to do this, but I wouldn't want everybody to think that's the way to go, because I think that the National School Lunch Program has good guidelines and regulations, and depending on who's in charge of what district, you know, you could have Amanda who is so, you know, she cares about nutrition, but you could have someone who has an administration who only cares about the bottom line and wants them to make money. In the years past, they had districts that made a lot of money selling a lot of junk food, and they liked that because they didn't ever have to put out money for any new equipment or anything. Unlike my district, who is so supportive, and we're serving great food and we're getting great participation, which, again, ours sort of tanked in 2012 when the regulations changed. But it is slowly picking up, and actually has really picked up at one of my elementary schools, is 150%. So what we were serving
up in terms
before,
of kids eating it,
meals,
it.
Right. So I wouldn't want to take that from – I wouldn't want everyone to think that that's the way to go. Also, lost my train of thought.
That's okay. I'm getting a sense of how it's tough to balance, you know, the financial pressures.
It is
with
tough.
The pressure to make meals.
It is
healthier.
Tough. And what a lot of people don't realize is a school food service program is actually a business within the school. It's not subsidized the way the rest of the school is. It's meant to be a free enterprise, which means money in, money out. And if that's the way that your district wants you to run, a lot of people are running in the red, which means the school district has to pay the bills at the end of this, at the end of the year. And if they don't want to do that, they can put a lot of pressure on this food service director to make ends meet.
So they don't like it, Doris, when you come before the school board and say, sorry, didn't make a profit this year, I need a subsidy of $20,000 or $30,000 or whatever.
I have to say that my district is extremely supportive, and they actually budget $75,000 for my district, but I don't always use it.
Let's take another call. This is Jeremy in Portsmouth. Hi, Jeremy. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just thinking about this from a cultural aspect, and the reason why is that while I live here in here in New Hampshire, I actually grew up and went all the way through high school back in Louisiana. And when I had school-age children, I returned to Louisiana for a time and had to enroll my children in school. It was a tremendous disappointment to me to walk back into the school lunch line and not find all the wonderful, delicious things that our lunch ladies used to cook back home in Louisiana. We didn't have the gumbos. We didn't have the jambalayas, the sauce pecans. We didn't have these wonderful cultural dishes from Louisiana being cooked. They didn't have the equipment to bake these fresh yeast rolls that they used to make every single day.
Jeremy, you're making me hungry.
imagine a group of these, you know, middle-aged moms and grandmothers being together in a kitchen all day long from South Louisiana and trying to figure out what to cook a couple hundred kids. Well, I mean, it was amazing. Yeah. I loved our lunch ladies because they were fantastic cooks.
So it got more standardized and less culturally interesting.
yeah, there's all the culture of Louisiana was practically was taken out of the school program and replaced with these very generic food choices.
Sure.
And it was, I mean, in my opinion, it was travesty.
Jeremy, thank you for calling. And I'm thinking I might make gumbo now this week because he's reminding me how good it is. What do you think, Amanda? I have heard this complaint from others that it's just the federalization of this program, and it's always been a federal program, probably even when, you know, Jeremy was a kid, but that it's gotten more sort of generic and less interesting.
So I think this goes back to what I was discussing before, and it's what's the household food culture like? What are these kids eating at home? What's going to be familiar to them? And what are they going to take when they come to school? Unfortunately, when we have great ideas that we think are going to be absolutely fantastic and we put them on a menu, unfortunately, the student acceptability or what they're taking, the financial implications do not line up with what we're trying to do and expose them to. And for example, I had roasted Brussels sprouts last week, and I love roasted Brussels sprouts. I think every student should eat roasted Brussels sprouts. However, if it's not familiar to the students, it's not going to go into their tummies, and it's not, the money's not going to go in the bank for us, unfortunately. So we can make those choices and put these ethnic different dishes to expose these students to the different experiences, but whether they're successful or not, at the end of the day, we have to make a business decision, unfortunately.
Well, and again, Doris reminds us of the importance of the financials of this. So you can't be losing tons and tons of money. You know, on this issue of sort of generic foods and less interesting, and Jeremy, thank you so much for the call. Stacey Perslow, what do you think? I mean, this is probably something that you are working with as director of the New Hampshire Farm to School program, trying to get those local flavors back on the menu.
We are. I did a project with some students last semester here at UNH on developing some seasonal menus for the program. And Doris was actually going to implement some of those recipes. I don't know if she has yet. We have a conference coming up in May, so we'll be offering a number of workshops on seasonal menu writing and other aspects of farm to school.
Well, here's another email, and I'll throw this to you. It's from Andy in the Upper Valley. He says, as a vegetable grower, I see a lot of potential for selling local produce to schools. However, Andy says, my perception is that most schools don't have the extra resources to purchase local vegetables that might be more expensive than those from California or Mexico. He says, local growers will often need to get a higher price for their products to make it worthwhile. Compare the prices they could get at a farmer's market for the same product. Dollar for dollar, it's no question the retail model is better. So Andy asks, and I'll throw this to you again, Stacey, are there programs that can help the schools pay slightly higher prices to both support the local vegetable grower and provide the freshest possible food to the students? Thank you, Andy, for the email.
So I wouldn't say there's a program, but there's ways to, when you're creating your menus, if, say, you wanted to do, you know, a salad bar on Friday that featured New Hampshire fruits and vegetables, and then the other meals during the week were cost less, then you can sort of balance it out that way. So yes, I hear that a lot around the state that the, you know, local food is too expensive, but that's not always true either. You know, sometimes it's less expensive, particularly if something happens in California and the price of tomatoes and lettuce skyrockets, and that sometimes makes local lettuce and tomatoes cheaper. So you kind of have to be in tune to all of that in order to make farm to school work.
Okay. Go ahead, Doris. And Amanda, I can see you want to jump in too.
One of the things that I've always said is that, you know, at the end of that farmer's market, of course, they are taking things home. And they're left with the vegetables that might have a flaw or a mark or, you know, something that's not a perfect tomato. We slice and dice everything we use. So we have a... they have a better chance of selling that to us. I don't want to pay top dollar for heirloom tomatoes where I'm going to throw part of it away. But if they were to give us discounts, we would definitely jump on board with that. We can find other ways to balance the cost. I am really into local foods, so I'm always looking for that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Amanda.
And in Londonderry, we do work with several different local vendors where we can. And we're very fortunate to have an apple orchard, which is 0.4 miles from our high school facility. It's Max Apples. They're absolutely fantastic. They give us 8 cases of apples a week. But they're able to supply us in the quantity at which we need it. And Londonderry is the sixth largest district in New Hampshire. I sell 1,000 elementary lunches a day. I sell 750 middle school lunches a day. I sell 600 high school lunches a day. So for a farmer to be able to supply something at a cost that is going to be acceptable to me and in the quantity that I need guaranteed, because I'm writing menus 1-2 months in advance. It's very difficult sometimes to have individuals working with them that are going to be able to give me what I need in the quantities that I need them.
With the predictability that you need.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes you just don't know what's going to happen. Okay. Well, thank you again for that email, Andy. And let's go back to the phones. Al joins us from Stratford. Hi, Al. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Yeah. Hi. Hey, listen, my wife's in the restaurant business. She has been for 30 years. So we have 3 sons who are in college now. She taught them all to cook. And presenting something to a student is one thing. We have one son that's fairly finicky eater, but now he's making his own foods and he's getting quite creative. And I don't know if there couldn't be a program where the students are involved in the back of the house, in the kitchen. There may be some liability issues that could be worked out, but food is love. And to teach them about the food, to have them work at some of the small farms, the business she's in, some of her staff has gone over and helped a small farmer start his business, and he's flourished. And Co Brown does that as a part of requirement of graduating so many hours of community service. Why not get the kids involved rather than saying, here's what we're offering, how do you like it?
Yeah.
Teach them how to like it. Teach them how to love it. They'll bring it home. Oyster River's one of the communities with more money than others, but Rochester, Farmington, Somersworth. Teach these kids how to eat properly. They'll cook for their parents. You'll change generations.
So put them on the farm and put them in the kitchen. What do you think, Doris?
We actually have a summer program that offers cooking classes. And also last year we did after-school workshop for parent and child cooking classes at both of my elementary schools. And they were really well attended. And the parents loved it. And the students loved it. And they all tried everything they cooked and gave us a thumbs up or thumbs down or in between. But we noticed that some of the students that had taken that class were not former lunch participation students, and now they are. So it definitely helps to get the students involved. We also have a few high school students that have worked in the kitchen with our manager there, and that's been also helpful. Mostly it's special ed. They're learning life skills, and it's just always good to get kids in the kitchen. I totally agree.
Here's an email from Rachel who says, early introduction is crucial in getting children comfortable with new foods. Not all families are doing this sort of introduction at home. So if we as a country let go of serving mandatory vegetables at school, we can potentially raise a partially veggie-free generation, people who grow up thinking that they don't eat green things. Rachel says, I know that there are some very bright points in school nutrition, like Oyster River, but there are other districts that still have some distance to go, and we can't give up. Fresh ideas like offering student choice in salad bars will keep up the momentum. Rachel, thank you for the email. This gets back to something that you said earlier, Amanda, this mandate that each meal have a fresh fruit or veggie. It's tricky because Rachel's right. Of course, we all want kids to eat this stuff. On the other hand, if they're not eating it and throwing it away, it's a waste. So I just wonder what you think about Rachel's point that we can't give up.
There's definitely what I call breeding healthy eaters. And we're finding that with there are some programs within New Hampshire. One is the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program, which is a subsidized program where everyone gets to eat a fresh fruit or vegetable at the elementary level. And I worked in a district previously where we qualified for that program. And it was fantastic because we introduced a variety of different fruits and vegetables and created the routine and expectation that fruits and vegetables are part of my daily life. It was absolutely fantastic. That's not something that's available to us in Londonderry because we're only 7% free and reduced lunch. My previous district was 43% free and reduced lunch. So we're ineligible for that program. So there are some really great things that are occurring, but it just becomes very difficult in terms of facility. Going back again, we have very much the cattle corral, if so you say, in the elementary, where I am it's a matter of space. I don't have the space to offer carrots, celery, radishes, and cherry tomatoes that day to give them the options of, hey, here's four different vegetables. Choose one, and you have to have that on your tray. Unfortunately, the space in which I have to work with, they're only being offered one or two different items.
Oh, and you talked earlier about the choice and how they like that.
Absolutely. And if you give someone a choice and say, hey, it's A or B, they're going to have, you know, more of a say and feel that they're incorporated in the process as opposed to being dictated to.
Well, and that's sort of how food has gone anyway in the last couple of decades, right, Doris? I mean, everything's more sort of a la carte. You go to a food court and, you know, you can pick whatever you want. I mean, that's kind of where we're at as a society anyway.
It has. As I said before, children eat out now all the time. The first thing I did in this district was put salad bars in all four schools, and schools can get them free at saladbarstoschools.org. It's a really wonderful program, and they get everything. They get the pans and everything. The other thing is that in order to cook this food, sometimes the cooks need training, and I just wanted to say that School Nutrition Association of New Hampshire is providing training for the people in the kitchens. Twice a year we have conferences where we provide training, hands-on training, and give them information that will help make these transitions.
Wow. Well, real interesting. Thank you both so much for being here. We really appreciate it. And Stacy Perslow, thank you also for being with us.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.